Right, angels and demons. This is week 13. And this will be the last week we're going to be touching on this topic. Tonight we're going to be looking at exorcism. And considering the giants of Genesis 6. So, exorcism. Because we talked last time about demonology, or demonization, I should say, a demon possession. And so, what to do, what kind of response to that reality. And then we have to... We need to look at Genesis 6. And the reason... the reason for a look at Genesis 6 is there has been probably since, certainly pre-Christian era. It's considered one of the oldest points of interpreting. There has been this notion that floated among the Jews and was very prevalent among the early church fathers that demons mated with women, and we had this race of semi-divine beings. What the Romans or Greeks would have called the Titans. And there's this idea that that in Genesis 6 we have sort of a an element of pagan mythology, maybe, that has crept in. There are a lot of people today who are moving back to this early position that you have angels that are having children, procreating with women, and the result would be a race of giants. And there's a lot of speculation as to giants, and there are conspiracy theories now about reptilian people, and that's probably outside of the church per se, although I'm not entirely sure that it is. Within evangelical circles, it's become somewhat... somewhat accepted that this idea of angels and women mating and producing giants, that this is a real thing. So I want to look at that passage as a point of conclusion. Consider that position and explain to you what I believe is really going on there and why they're just simply... wrong. Now, you probably already have some idea of why, or you should have some idea of why they're wrong, based on things that we've already said about the nature of angels. I will, I'll point that out again when we get to that point, when we look at the passage, but... there's a lot more going on in that passage that gives us, I think, a pretty good hint of what is really meant. And the interpretation that the ancient interpretation placed upon it arose, to a large extent, arose from... certain that the ancients had about the nature of angels that I think we have biblical reason to reject. So again, I'll point that out when we get to it. All right, so without taking up any more time, let's move to our first question. What should we think of exorcism? So, what is exorcism? We talk about that. Well, there is the idea throughout Scripture, throughout the New Testament in particular, we see this notion of casting out devils. But I'm not exactly sure that what's going on here is exactly the same thing as is intended by exorcism. And I'll explain why as we get into this question. We already talked about demonic possession, but let's consider it again briefly. The kinds of demonic possession range from what we would consider to be relatively harmless, like the spirit of infirmity in Luke 13:11,
and behold, there was a woman which had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bowed together and could in no wise lift up herself.
Or, again, the case of the blind and dumb demoniac in Matthew 12:22.
Matthew 12:22. Then was brought unto him one possessed with a devil, blind and dumb, and he healed him, insomuch that the blind and dumb both spake and saw.
So it ranges from that sort of low-key demonization to more violent cases of possession where attacks come on in fits after intervals of comparative quiet. And we see examples of that in Luke 9:42 and in Mark 9:18.
Luke 9:42, and as he was yet coming, the devil threw him down and tear him, and Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the child and delivered him again to his father. Mark 9:18, and wheresoever he taketh him, he teareth him, and he foameth and gnasheth with his teeth and findeth the way. And I spake to thy disciples that they should cast him out, and they could not.
Now what all of these have in common is we see there to be some kind of desire of sorts. Now, I use that word. Remember, demons are fallen angels, and angels do not have passions like men because they don't have corporeal bodies. But there seems to be, in these fallen angels, some sort of desire, if we can call it that, for a bodily tabernacle wherein to work their mischief and misery. So, for example, look at Matthew 12:45.
Matthew 12:45. Then goeth he and taketh with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so it shall be also unto this wicked generation.
Yeah, and barring being able to inhabit, in some sense, the body of men, or the bodies of men, then the demons want some other corporeal body in which to give vent to their rage. And again, when I speak of rage, I'm not speaking of that as so much as a passion. Although, there must be in these demons some kind of pleasure in being able to manipulate passions in corporeal bodies. And so we see that they're interested, if they can't have the body of a man, to have some sort of corporeal body. If you look at Matthew 8:31 and 32.
Matthew 8, verses 31 and 32. So the devils besought him, saying, If thou cast us out, suffer us to go away into the herd of swine. And he said unto them, Go. And when they were come out, they went into the herd of swine. And behold, the whole herd of swine ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished in the waters.
Now, among those people who think that angels are, in fact, fallen angels in particular, perhaps, possessors of some kind of corporeal body, or perhaps, as some, that they have what they would call a spirit body, and their idea is when they fall that they lose this spirit, spiritual soma, body, and they're looking to clothe themselves then with some sort of natural soma or body. Different about the difference between the body being sown a natural body, that is a soulish body, a soulish soma, and raised a spiritual body, that is a pneumatic soma. And there are people who think that the spiritual soma is what the fallen angels now lack, meaning that they latch on to a soulish body, which is a corporeal body. I think that they're mistaken in this idea of bodies, or what soma means in this particular case. I think that they're searching for an answer contrary to the best understanding that the church has had regarding angels, which is that they're non-corporeal beings, first of all. And we'll come back to that when we get to Genesis 6. But beyond that, that there would be some sort of limitation we've already talked about. Of course, angels are not omnipresent. There is some sort of locality, and does that require some sort of corporeal presence? Well, the church, since the Middle Ages at least, has consistently said no to that for a number of reasons, some of which we've talked about earlier. But the fact is that these angels do have a form. They're not formless substances. And the form is, in fact, an estate or a principality. There's a limitation. There is some kind of what we might call a soma that they have, and they turn away from that. Does this mean that they now are seeking, you know, a corporeal body in the case of fallen angels? I don't know that that's clear, and I don't know that that's even necessary, because it doesn't seem like they all do this. You know, not all fallen angels are trying to possess corporeal bodies. It seems that they're doing this really as a matter of assault against mankind, that they view mankind as an interference or some kind of problem which needs to be overcome in some way, an obstacle. And that idea fits more with some of the things as well that we've already talked about. That they certainly would have known from eternity, they would have known something of the plan of salvation respecting mankind. And that it did not take in the angels, at least in that way. And we talked about that somewhat when when I talked about the fall of Satan and perhaps some hints as to why Satan might have been lifted up with pride. You know, didn't like the idea that the species of mankind would be elevated over the angels and any of the angels, and particularly over himself. So the problems I think we run into are that these beings are non-corporeal, and there's no evidence that they had any kind of corporeality from which they've fallen, number one. Number two, that even if they, in some sense, in turning from God, they relinquish stability of form. And I do think that there is something to be said with respect to that point. Some of the medievalists hint at those kinds of things, that they then are able to take on other forms. That does not mean that, again, that they're necessarily desirous, if you will, of having a corporeal body, so much as they seem to take some sort of perverse pleasure in tormenting men. And that does, the idea of them tormenting men is in keeping with what we already know about their, you know, part of their purpose and how God uses them to torment the wicked. Now, the heathens themselves identify their gods with demons. And I want to give you a quote from Herodotus, an ancient historian. He says, the Scythians ridicule us because we celebrate the Bacchanals, which are, wine feasts where people got drunk. They remember the connection I talked about with drug use or getting out of your mind. That was sort of what was going on there. And the god possesses us. And the word, the Greek there is hatheos lambane. The god possesses us. But now, he goes on to say, the same demon, houtasad daimon, hath taken possession of your king, for he celebrates the bacchanals and is filled with fury by this god, hupotu theu mainetai. All right? So, that's a description of what happens, according to Herodotus, with these demonic possessions that he's talking about. And what's interesting is Luke, the inspired historian, relates a similar account of demonic possession which produced like effects in the person possessed.
Luke 9, verse 39. And lo, a spirit taketh him, and he suddenly crieth out, and it teareth him that he foameth again, and bruising him hardly departeth from him.
Yeah, Luke actually uses the word limbane, the spirit possesses him, right, takes him. And then he begins to recount this phenomenon. So the phenomenon of demonic possession is something familiar across the spectrum, Jews and Gentiles. Whereas the Gentiles viewed it as being possessed by the gods, and they actually wanted this to occur very often. All right, they within a certain religious context, they were open to it. And outside of that, if it happened, they viewed it as a sign that they needed to sacrifice or do some sort of obeisance or offer some oblation to their gods. To the Bible tells us these gods are demons, right? And it's not as though the heathen don't use the term demon to describe these things. It's just they don't attach to the word demon all of the same negativity that we find attached when the apostles talk about demons. Right. So the ancient heathen didn't see it that way, but possession was something that was a widely recognized phenomenon. Additionally, there were those demonic possessions which consisted in inspiration, such as the woman with the Pythian spirit, and the word there is Pneuma Pythona, spirit of Python, the serpent god who guarded the oracle of Delphi. That's what it's referring to in Acts 16:16.
Acts 16:16, and it came to pass, as we went to prayer, a certain damsel possessed with a spirit of divination met us, which brought her masters much gain by soothsaying.
Yeah, so here Luke uses that term Pneuma Puthona. The spirit of, it's translated the spirit of divination, but it's really the spirit of Python, and he's linking this for his readers, who are Gentiles, he's a Gentile, to the spirit of Python, the snake, the serpent god, that guarded the oracle at Delphi, which was very well known and well attested oracle in the ancient world. Now, people who want to deny the supernatural really have to think that there was sort of this mass delusion going on in the sense that these people were all hearing voices together and recording what is being said together. The fact is that this was happening, it was well attested, and, you know, Luke knows of this. Right, so they see this and they understand that these demonic forces, the gods of the Gentiles, are demons. And these bodily possessions are demons. They're not just God, the heathen gods are demons. Paul himself appears to entertain no doubt regarding the demonical nature of the heathen gods. For although he does say that an idol is nothing, if you look at 1 Corinthians 8:4.
1 Corinthians 8:4, as concerning therefore the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is none other God but one.
The fact is, he goes on to affirm the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons, or devils, as it's translated in the King James. 1 Corinthians 10:20.
1 Corinthians 10:20, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God, and I would not that you should have fellowship with devils.
And lest any should think that this is some kind of gentilic perversion of the religion of Moses or something like that, the fact is, what Paul's teaching, what Luke reflects to understand answerable in the Gentile world, all of this reflects the teaching of Moses in the law. If we look at Leviticus 17:7 and Deuteronomy 32:17.
Leviticus 17:7, and they shall no more offer their sacrifices unto devils, after whom they have gone a whoring. This shall be a statute forever unto them throughout their generations. Deuteronomy 32:17, for they sacrificed unto devils, not to God, gods whom they knew not, and new gods that came newly up, whom your fathers feared not.
So, there are throughout the Bible, there's an understanding that the heathen gods are really devils. They're demons. And these demons manifest themselves in two ways. They manifest themselves either through some sort of bodily possession where people are, you know, writhing and anywhere from the very minor spirit of infirmity where somebody's bowed over to these very violent outbursts. They're also very often accompanied with or sometimes only manifested by inspirations, right? Certain the ability to foretell certain things. And as we're going to see in a couple of minutes, the demons, when they're doing this, very often tell the truth a lot. If you've ever wondered how or why certain people are able to predict things far out into the future, you know, some of it could be an expression of wisdom, but certainly if they're involved in occultic activity at all, of any sort, you have reason, I think, to believe maybe that there's something else going on here, because we know about these demonic inspirations. Now, under the Old Testament Mosaical administration, various activities and practices which might lead to such possessions were strictly forbidden to the Jews. All right, the Hebrew people. Look at Deuteronomy 18:10-14.
Deuteronomy 18:10-14. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord, and because of these abominations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. Thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. For these nations which thou shalt possess, hearken unto observers of times, and unto diviners. But as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee so to do.
So one thing that separates the church and people of God from the rest of the world at this time, and I would argue today as well, is the church and people of God separate themselves with a very hard line from any and all practices which could be opening the door to this kind of demonic possession or inspiration. In fact, under the Old Testament, those who engaged in such activities which would bring demonism into Israel were to be put to death. Look at Leviticus 20:27.
A man also, or woman that hath a familiar spirit, or that is a wizard, shall surely be put to death. And they shall stone them with stones, their blood shall be upon them.
And while I don't intend to get into this at this point, you know, the Bible, when it says, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, there was a time when Christendom understood that applied to nations and kingdoms under the New Testament as well. That we would not allow the entrance of this sort of thing to occur in a nation. While I know the Salem witch trials and that sort of thing are very unpopular today, the fact is, when you read the account of what happened, although there may be some elements of hysteria surrounding it, the fact is that in the main it was conducted in a relatively careful manner, and it was certainly in keeping with the law of God that these sorts of things should not be tolerated in a society. Now, in Israel, however, through the neglect of the magistrates enforcing this, or even themselves using such wicked practices, that is, the magistrates, the society, the Hebrew society, was increasingly demonized. So look at, for example, 2 Chronicles 33, 6.
Second Chronicles 33, verse 6, and he caused his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. Also he observed times and used enchantments and used witchcraft and dealt with a familiar spirit and with wizards. He wrought much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger.
Now, I bring this verse in here to point out something before we move on, and that is 2 Chronicles is the last book of the Hebrew Old Testament. Right? I know it's not in our Old Testament, but for the Hebrews it would have been. And chapter 33 is right at the end. You've only got a couple more chapters before you reach the end of the entire book. Why is that important? Well, we see Manasseh, the king, a wicked king, in Jerusalem, which is now the southern kingdom. We knew that the northern kingdom had been demonized earlier. But this demonization that should have been held back and not allowed in Israel had not only permeated Samaria, the northern kingdom, but now in Manasseh it's become, according to the chronicler, commonplace in the nation of Judea, in the southern kingdom. Now, why is that important? Because by the time we get to Jesus and his apostles, demonic possession was not an uncommon phenomenon. We see that in the Gospels, but also look at Acts 8, verse 9.
Acts 8, verse 9. But there was a certain man called Simon, which before time in the same city used sorcery and bewitched the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one.
Nor were the Jews exempted from the spiritual plague. If you look at Acts 13, 6.
Acts 13, verse 6. And when they had gone through the isle unto Paphos, they found a certain sorcerer, a false prophet, a Jew, whose name was Bar-Jesus.
So, when people say, well, where did all of this come from in the time of Christ? You know, you don't see it in the Old Testament. No, you don't under Moses' law originally. Why? It's not that it wasn't there, that they didn't know that it was there, right? How did they deal with it as a society? Well, the answer is, if you practice this stuff that would bring it on, they put you to death, all right? You weren't allowed to be part of the society. The same held, as they say, in Christian nations, later on in the history of mankind, you know, in the history of Western Europe, this becomes something that is not tolerated among the nations that have been Christianized. And the reason is this: when this is tolerated, it has this propensity to overrun an entire society. So, before we talk about exorcism per se, I think it's important to understand contextually that demons only need to be cast out in a society where the magistrate refuses to do its job. Right. If the magistrate was weeding out and keeping out this kind of influence, it would have been unnecessary. So, it's in this context now that Israel itself has been overrun, that the Lord Jesus gave to his apostles the power to cast out unclean spirits. In Matthew 10:1.
Matthew 10:1, and when he called unto him his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease.
Now, we can call that an exorcism of sorts, I suppose. But this exorcism, I think, is to be contrasted with those who claim to have an office of exorcist. And there's only one time when that's used. It's in Acts 19:13. Want to look at that?
Acts 19:13. Then certain of the vagabond Jews, exorcists, took upon them to call over them which had evil spirits the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, "We adjure you by Jesus, whom Paul preacheth."
Yeah. Vagabond Jews, exorcist, or the Greek is exorkiston, which means to command under oath or adjure out. And I would suggest that the tenor of what happens in this passage, if we notice the progression of the story, it seems to warn against using the gospel simply as a response to demonic speech or demonic inspirations. Look at Acts 19, now verses 14 to 16.
Acts 19, verses 14 through 16. And there were seven sons of one Sceva, a Jew, and the chief of the priests, which did so. And the evil spirit answered and said, "Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are ye?" And the man in whom the evil spirit was leaped on them and overcame them and prevailed against them, so that they fled out of that house naked and wounded.
Yeah, to be an unbelieving Jew who's going to be an exorcist, probably not a good idea. Now, why is this story in the book of Acts? We know, for example, from the caves in Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that by that time, this is some sort of religious community shortly prior to Christ, by that time, it had become somewhat commonplace for the Jews to make talismans we would call them charms, out of portions of the Bible and other sayings of the sages in order to ward off these demons. Now, the reason they're dealing with all this demonization is what? They've opened the door. They've mingled with the heathen. All right? And this theme, by the way, is going to come up again. You may think, oh, why are we talking about exorcism and Genesis 6? Because there is a similarity, actually. All right? Even though it's not what a lot of people think. There's been a mingling with the heathen. The mingling here shows itself in this. There appears that there's a similarity between these exorcists and the adjuring of the demons. For example, Matthew 5:7. Or Mark, excuse me, 5:7.
Mark 5. Verse 7, he cried with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not."
I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not. Who's speaking there? The demon. Right? That word adjure is the word, that part of the word, if you look at X, or kiston, take off the prefix, the X, or kisto, or kidzo, is the root word, and it means to adjure. So these exorcists are using a method that is in some way reflective of the way the demons talk to Jesus and to the apostles. And I would suggest it is tied up in exactly what the devil does when he tempts Jesus, and that is the devil quotes the Bible, but he doesn't quote it from any principle of living faith or with a desire to glorify God. There's no real efficacy against the incursion of demons once the door has been opened to them, except in and through the name of Jesus. That's clear. Look at Luke 11, 19 and 20.
Luke 11, 19 and 20. And if I, by Beelzebub, cast out devils, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore shall they be your judges. But if I, with the finger of God, cast out devils, no doubt the kingdom of God has come upon you.
Right. However, the fact is this name, Jesus, is not to be used as a talisman or a charm. It must be used in faith to be effective. So look at Mark 9, 38 and 39.
Mark 9, 38 and 39. And John answered him, saying, Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and he followeth not us. And we forbade him, because he followed not us. But Jesus said, Forbid him not, for there is no man which shall do a miracle in my name that can lightly speak evil of me.
And there's a sense in which this power belongs to all saints, particularly to those who are called to minister in the apostolic succession. So look at Mark, for example, Mark 3, 14 and 15, compared with Mark 16, 17 and 18.
Mark 3, verses 14 and 15. And he ordained 12 that they should be with him, and that he might send them forth to preach, and to have power to heal sickness and to cast out devils.
Mark 16, verse 17. And these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out devils. They shall speak with new tongues.
Yeah, if you look at the connection between casting out devils and healing, and in Mark 16, speaking with new tongues, right? The speaking with new tongues there, I think, is, and I think I pointed this out before, but let me point it out again. It is, in fact, in opposition to demonic inspirations, right? These things all go together. You're not going to be speaking words inspired by the devil, right, or by demons. You're going to be speaking words that are inspired by the Spirit of God. It's new tongues, right? Your tongue will be kept from that kind of demonic inspiration. So there is in this, I think, the idea that there's something inherent in the gospel to cast out demons. Right? Demonic activity arises in the absence of the true religion. To use the name of Jesus apart from faith is to take the Lord's name in vain, contrary to Exodus 20, verse 7.
Exodus 20, verse 7, Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain.
So what do they do? Well, when Jesus or Paul meet with demons, how do they respond? Demon, case of demons speaking to them. Look at Luke 8, 28 and Acts 16, verse 17.
Luke 8, verse 28. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and with a loud voice said, What have I to do with thee? Jesus, thou Son of God Most High, I beseech thee, torment me not.
In Acts 16, verse 17, the same followed Paul and us and cried, saying, These men are the servants of the Most High God, which show unto us the way of salvation.
Yeah, now I want you to stop and think. When the demon says, I beseech thee, Jesus, thou Son of God, is he telling the truth? Is Jesus the Son of God? Yes. Paul and the apostles, are these men teaching the way of salvation? Sure. But what they do, the response of Jesus and of the apostles, is very interesting. In both cases, they refuse the testimony of the demons, even though it was accurate. What the demons said was true. They already knew something was wrong here. How did they know there was something wrong? Because they're not speaking the truth from a motive that seems desirous to glorify God. Right? Like when the devil quotes the Bible to Jesus. You know, he's is he quoting the Bible? Does he know the Bible? Yes, he does. Why is he doing it? To ensnare. They gloss over, and they always do this, they gloss over. The only time they actually engage is when Jesus asks, you know, what is thy name? He says, Legion. Right? That's it. They don't receive any additional testimony from these demons other than that they're there. Because Jesus only is to have the preeminence. See, Colossians 1:18.
Colossians 1, verse 18. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence.
And it's certain that acceptance of the testimony of the demons could not be attended with freedom, but with death. Romans 6, verse 23.
The wages of sin is death. The gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord.
Why would it be sinful or wicked for them to accept the testimony from demons, even though they're telling the truth in that case? Because the law tells us specifically we're not to have intercourse with familiar spirits. We're not to engage them. The end of it will be death. The Bible's telling us this. Think about the first interaction of mankind with a demonic force in the garden. The woman was deceived. This is how man fell into sin. Right? It can't end well. So, you know, these books and movies and all of this stuff where they have exorcists who are interacting with these demons and talking with them and all of that, it's not only fictional, it's preparing people to believe a lie. You're not to have any kind of communication with familiar spirits. Once you know it's a familiar spirit, what's thy name? Legion, because we're many. That's all you need to know. The rest of it is immaterial, because anything beyond determining that there is a familiar spirit there, a demonic possession, is only going to be designed to confuse you, to ensnare you, to entrap you, and to cause you to fall into wickedness. Whatever benefit is received from demons must serve only to work spiritual darkness, and therefore it must be rejected. 2 Corinthians 4:4.
2 Corinthians 4:4. In whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them.
And so it's for that reason that if this deliverance from these spirits is a deliverance that is done simply because they're unwelcome, not because they're unholy or unclean, just because they're inconvenient, the result is not going to be lasting. Look at Luke 11:24-25.
Luke 11:24-25. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places seeking rest. And finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished.
Hence, when deliverance doesn't consist in merely exorcising the demon, like the exorcists would try to do, but in establishing that faith relation with Jesus Christ, who's the deliverer. You cast them out. You don't engage them on their level. You just command them with authority, right? You cast them out. You have to have that faith relation with Jesus who's the deliverer. Look at Luke 11, 21 and 22.
Luke 11, verses 21 and 22. When a strong man armed keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. But when a stronger than he shall come upon him and overcome him, he taketh from him all his armor wherein he trusted and divideth his spoils.
Right, and thus they did not adjure, right? Didn't adjure these demons to come out. How are you gonna, you're going to place a demon under oath? What are you talking about? I mean, these are lying spirits. They're unclean spirits. They simply command them. Ekbalo, cast out with authority. And when they do so, these unclean spirits depart. In Matthew 9, verse 33.
And when the devil was cast out, the dumb spake, and the multitudes marveled, saying it was never so seen in Israel.
So once you have reason to believe you have this situation, this is not something which requires, you know, a lot of consultation with, especially with the demon itself or the demons themselves. Right? You pray and command. You know, it may take prayer and fasting. Why? Because you may need to have yourself chastened to the point where you're going to be focused. But you can't allow yourself to be roped into some kind of discussion. It simply needs to be commanded with the authority of Christ to come out. And you pray with that in mind. It's not all this other stuff that people come up with, you know, these elaborate liturgical rites and you know, sprinkling holy water and signs of crosses and all these other... These are elements of paganism. Where do you think they came from in the first place? Probably through the intercourse with familiar spirits to begin with. Like, they're not being turned off by that. Okay, there simply needs to be a stepping forward, faithful stepping forward, and refusing to be brought under that power yourself. And that only is going to happen when there is, in fact, a clear exercise of saving faith. So, we have this situation. Why is this a problem in our society? Why is it a problem even in the church? Because of the mingling with the heathen. Because, you remember, when you do any of those things that we talked about last time, you know, when you're involving yourself in occult practices, when you involve yourself in any kind of mind-altering practices, that's why they had the Bacchanalian feast, where they had the heavy wine use. They'd get drunk and they would get high. You know, when they had that opportunity, when they had other things, they would bring those into the mix as well. Why are they doing all of that? You know, why do these shamans and primitive seers, why do they utilize all of these mind-altering drugs and so on? They're doing so to make way for this communication. They want to be possessed. The doors have been opened in the West through this sort of thing. All right, let's move on to the second question then. What should we think of the giants mentioned in Genesis 6? Uh, you know, this is an interesting question, I think, at a certain level. It seems to be highly agitated now. The first thing we need to note is the term translated giants in Genesis 6 is Nephilim. Look at Genesis 6:4.
Genesis 6, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown.
And it's from the root Nephal, meaning to fall or be cast down, to fail, often to the point of ruin. For example, Proverbs 24:17.
Proverbs 24:17. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth.
Yeah, so that falleth right there is the same word, that root word, to fall. Elsewhere, it's only used in Numbers in reference to the sons of Anak. By the way, Anak is a word which itself refers to the neck. Anak. You hear the word neck in there? Anak. Probably linguistically there is a connection. Anyway, the sons of Anak, who are described as men of great stature, from which comes the Septuagint or the Greek translation, gigantes, giants, in Numbers 13, 32 and 33.
Numbers 13, verses 32 and 33. They brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children, of Israel, saying, the land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight.
Yeah, the Hebrew there says that these men of Anak, these neck men, just means they have long necks, that they were men of great measurement, which means that they were tall. They were what we might call giants. Okay, but we have to understand that the idea of giant is imported into Genesis 6 from Numbers 13, not the other way around. Whether or not it's in view in Genesis 6, that actually is something which I think is somewhat debatable. The precise sense of Nephilim, especially in its context in Genesis, I think, may derive from a word meaning an untimely birth, nephel, or abortion. It's untimely birth or abortion. Job 3:16 and Ecclesiastes 6:3.
Job 3, verse 16, whereas in hidden untimely birth I had not been, as infants which never saw light. Ecclesiastes 6, verse 3, if a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he.
Okay, so first of all, you know, if we think about Nephilim, what the primary meaning is, it really is not referring to great stature, although they may have been. We'll come back to that. All right? Not impossible. The primary sense here has more to do, I think, with them being fallen. And I know there are some people who think that this has to do with there is a sense in which Nephal can mean to fall upon violently, and so they would translate Nephilim as tyrants. And while that does seem to make some sense in Genesis 6, I actually think that the context, because it's using this to describe the offspring, I think, as we're going to see, it has to do more with the notion that these are the result, these are the offspring, these Nephilim are the offspring, which represent an untimely birth or something that would have been better off aborted. And we'll talk about why as we get into this passage a little bit more. But they're clearly the result of some kind of fall. And that is also in view, and we'll come back to that as well. Now, additionally, and this is a much more widely used word that's translated giants, and that word is Rephaim. If you look at Deuteronomy 2:20, for example.
Deuteronomy 2, verse 20, that also was accounted a land of giants. Giants dwelt there in old times, and the Ammonites called them Zamzumims.
Yeah, and the justification here now for using the word giants to translate Rephaim is based upon the details about the Rephaim, where they're said to be tall as the Anakim in Deuteronomy 2:11 and 21.
Deuteronomy 2:11, which also were accounted giants as the Anakim, but the Moabites called them Emims. In verse 21, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them. They succeeded them and dwelt in their stead.
Okay, so what I think is interesting about this word, Rephaim, and it's used of some of the people like the Hittites and so on, you'll find this used just to describe a tribe of people. But this word Rephaim is used to describe those who are dead as well. You look at Isaiah 26, 14 and 19 and Psalm 88, 10 and 11.
Isaiah 26, verse 14, they are dead, they shall not live, they are deceased, they shall not rise. Therefore hast thou visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. And verse 19, thy dead men shall live, together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust, for thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead.
Psalm 88, verses 10 and 11. Wilt thou show wonders to the dead? Shall the dead arise and praise thee? Selah. Shall thy loving kindness be declared in the grave, or thy faithfulness in destruction?
Yeah, so shall the dead arise and praise thee? Shall the Rephaim arise and praise thee? The dead ones. Yeah, Rephaim refers to shades, what we call shades or even ghost like existence of the dead. It especially is a term, Rephaim, to describe the inhabitants of hell. For example, Proverbs 9:18.
Proverbs 9, verse 18, but he knoweth not that the dead are there and that her guests are in the depths of hell.
Yeah, so while I think there's reason to think some of these ancient peoples were of greater height than usual or ordinary. For example, Deuteronomy 3:11.
Deuteronomy 3, verse 11. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Rabith of the children of Ammon? 9 cubits was the length thereof, and 4 cubits the breadth of it, after the cubit of a man.
Yeah, so Og is of the remnant of the Rephaim. Look at Joshua 12:4.
Joshua 12, verse 4. And the coast of Og, king of Bashan, which was of the remnant of the giants that dwelt at Ashtaroth and at Edrei.
And we know from Deuteronomy 3:11, his bed is somewhere between 13 and 14 feet long. Twice the length of a California king-size bed. And as wide as a standard, I think, about a standard king-size bed. Or even maybe a California king. Right? So as wide as that for one person. Now, there's some discussion on this passage suggesting that the bed in view is actually not his bed, that it might be a sarcophagus, and therefore he might not be quite as large as that bed might suggest. Because sarcophagus has within it the casket, and then the bodies within the casket, and each one takes up some room. But we still have a rather large figure under consideration. And so the Bible's not unwarranted in using the term giant, right? And giantism, we know, is a trait very useful for warrior-like people. So, for example, 1 Samuel 17:4-7.
1 Samuel 17:4-7. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath. His height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had an helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass, and he had greaves of brass upon his legs, and a target of brass between his shoulders, and the staff of the spear of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him.
So Goliath, we know from this, is somewhere six cubits in a span, somewhere between 9 and 10 feet tall. Really between, probably more like between 9'9" and a little over 10 foot. Okay. that's somebody who's pretty tall, right? That's, relatively speaking, giant. And the language used, by the way, the mail armor that he's using it's scaled. So he's being portrayed as the seed of the serpent. All right, there's deliberate detail given of certain things to help convey this. And so, for example, when we're told that they're spreading themselves, the Philistines, in the Valley of Rephaim, it has a literary effect of making them denizens of hell. Look at 2 Samuel 5:18-22 and Isaiah 14:9.
2 Samuel 5:18-22. The Philistines also came and spread themselves in the Valley of Rephaim. And verse 22, and the Philistines came up yet again and spread themselves in the Valley of Rephaim.
Isaiah 14:9. Hell from beneath is moved for thee to meet thee at thy coming. It stirreth up the dead for thee, even all the chief ones of the earth. It hath raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations.
Yeah, it stirreth up the dead for thee, the Rephaim for thee. Where are they meeting? In the Valley of the Rephaim, or the Valley of the Giants. Elsewhere in the King James, it translates the Valley of the Giants. It's the Valley of the Rephaim. Who's there? Philistines. Who's champion of the Philistines? Goliath. What is he? He's a giant. And you can look at it two ways. You know, you can say he's a giant. He's scary. Look at him. He looks like a devil because he's got the scales like a serpent. Right? Or you can understand him as the Bible's portraying him, and that is, he's like the devil in the midst of hell. He's surrounded by dead souls, right? The souls of the wicked. In other words, he's already been defeated. He just doesn't know it yet. But from everything you're reading, you should get the picture. He's going to be defeated. Who will defeat him? Little David. Moreover, it carries the connotation of joining them to the demonic forces found in the abyss, because that's really hell. They're in the abyss. It's the abyss. Look at Job 26:5, and we want to look at Matthew 8:31-32.
Job 26:5, and dead things are formed from under the waters and the inhabitants thereof.
Yeah, dead things are formed under the waters. That is, Rephaim are formed under the water. Again, why is the abyss, the deep? Why do the pigs, as we're going to see here in a moment in Matthew 8, why do they want to go into the abyss? That's where Rephaim belong. So there's a demonic connection between the wicked and the demons that are ruling over them. No surprise here. All right? It doesn't mean necessarily that they're the same thing, but they're controlled by them, yeah.
Two quick things. I guess it makes it kind of interesting, too, because like in Revelation 20, when he's thrown into the bottomless pit, he can sort of fall forever. But also, so we go into the...
And the lake of fire. It's an abyss. It's a depth. And it sounds like it's water, but it's fire.
Right. Never ending.
Yeah.
Going back to the David and Goliath example. So when the army of Israel is there, all their soldiers, all their men are fearful.
Yeah.
Yet you have David, sort of this very extraordinary situation where he shows up and says, I'll take care of this guy. Would it be fair to sort of say that not that everybody knew all of this that was going on in terms of this is in some sort of way almost like almost this sign, if you will, or example of these people in the depths or whatever. But would it be fair to say that it was maybe indicative of the fact that all these men just, you know, on the surface were afraid of this guy, of the lack of that godly magistrate in Israel at the time?
Yes. There's certainly that. I mean, Psalm 23 has a reference to this, right? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. That is, I'm in the valley of the Rephaim, right? The valley of dead souls, where the damned belong, right? But I will fear no evil.
If thou art with me.
Yeah. So David knows this. He goes into hell, as it were. You know, there's a sense in which, as the demons have percolated up out of the depth and taken control of mankind, all of mankind has become this seething hell, which is why Christ, you know, there is a sense in which he descends into hell when he is incarnate. He's coming into these demons that have turned paradise into hell, and men are trapped in this. So, height, you know, are these ancient people, these wicked men, are they breeding for height? Yeah, of course they are. Because there's a great advantage to being able to field an army at this time of huge men. You throw one Goliath out on the field and the entire army of Israel is scared. So, you know, what's going on makes sense. Is there a demonic connection to it? Yes, there is, but it's not exactly what people are saying. So, let's look now at the passage regarding the giant offspring in Genesis. Because it stands as one of the most difficult in the history of the interpretation of the Pentateuch. The Genesis 6, 1-4.
Genesis 6, verses 1-4. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown.
All right, so this passage, the first thing we can say about it is this. It stands in what we call narrative relation to the previous chapter. How do we know that? It begins with what is known, it's the most common word in the Old Testament Hebrew, it's a vav. It's a vav consecutive. Okay, so this is not considered an independent story. This is to be read as part of a continuous narrative. Why is that important? Because the entire previous chapter chronicles the descendants of Seth. Look at Genesis 5:4.
Genesis
Genesis 5:4, and the days of Adam after he had begotten Seth were 800 years, and he begat sons and daughters.
Now, what is interesting is this. The rabbis have noted that every time in the Bible we come across the phrase, and it came to pass, anytime that occurs, trouble is not far behind. How do we know that? Well, let's look at a couple of examples. Ruth 1:1 and Esther 1:1.
Ruth 1:1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons.
Yeah, so it came to pass, what? In the days of the judges, famine. Esther 1:1.
Esther 1:1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 and 20 provinces.
Yeah, and they would say, and it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, Haman. Here comes Haman. By the way, these books begin with Vav consecutive. Why? Because they're not to be read independently of the rest of the histories of the Bible. Right? They may form, stories of their own in some sense, but they're not necessarily really self-contained. If you really want to understand the days of the judges for Ruth, you have to read Judges. If you really want to understand Ahasuerus and what's happening, you have to read of the captivity of the people under Jeremiah. You have to read the stories in Ezra and Nehemiah. You have to be familiar with a lot more. So here, it came to pass, when men began to multiply, and then in Genesis 6:5, God saw the wickedness of man was great.
Genesis 6:5, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
And we can see the same kind of thing happening in Genesis 11:2 and 4, and Genesis 14:1 and 2.
Genesis 11:2, and it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth.
Yeah, so what happens, and it came to pass, when they go to the east, what do they want to do? They want to build the Tower of Babel. Yeah, there is something to this, I think, the rabbis hit on. All right, 14.
Genesis 14, verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar.
Yeah, so what happened there, it came to pass in the days of Amraphel and all the others, they go to war. It's a big war. So it does seem that, you know, this is a hinting that trouble is coming. So we have at the end of the chronicling of Seth's descendants this note of trouble. And the scene is set when men, literally the Hebrew there says, Ha'adam, the Adam, when the Adam began to make himself great upon the face of the earth through the begetting of daughters. Look at Genesis 6:1.
Genesis 6, verse 1. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them.
Yeah, and I think there's something to that mentioning of daughters specifically. Right? And I think it has to do with this is reminding us of something. Remember what happened with the Protoevangelium. God promises to Adam and Eve that through the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent would have his head crushed. And Eve, when she has a child, a man child, it turns out it's Cain, but she says, I have a man. The Hebrew doesn't say from the Lord, it just says the Lord, Jehovah. In other words, she thought that maybe this was a promised seed. Okay? Now we see that there's a problem with the preservation of this promise of the coming seed of the woman, because what's brought into our view, and it's very unusual, that the daughters would be brought into view without reference to the sons, or without reference to all of the children. Okay, so the language is already hinting to us that there's something else we should be thinking about here. And I think it has to do with this Protoevangelium, but we're going to come back to that. All right? The word translated began, Heichel, that may have the connotation of breaking a covenant vow. And I say that because it's used that way, for example, in Numbers 30, verse 3, and Ezekiel 39, 7. And these are not the only places. I just took a couple of places where it's used this way.
Numbers 30, verse 3, if a woman also vow a vow unto the Lord and bind herself by a bond, being in her father's house in her youth.
Ezekiel 39, verse 7, so will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore, and the heathen shall know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel.
And I will not let them pollute. The word is the same word translated here, began. I will not let them begin my holy name anymore. Now, pollute. It can also mean to use in a common fashion, which is, in terms of taking the name of God, to use God's name in a common fashion would be to pollute or to break covenant. Right? It's a covenant-breaking act. So what's important is the daughters in view in this verse, in Genesis 6:1, are the same as those in the next verse. Look at Genesis 6:2.
Genesis 6, verse 2, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose.
Yeah, so it's the same daughters of men, or daughters of the Adam, that are in verse 2 as in verse 1. But the daughters in view are the fruit of a loosening, I suggest, of covenant bonds. Look at Psalm 55, 20.
Psalm 55, verse 20. He hath put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. He hath broken his covenant.
He hath broken his covenant. Or he hath hechel begun his covenant. That is, treated it in a common fashion. Right? It's the same word as began. And I suggest it's evidenced in their sexual immorality, especially in their daughters. Look at Leviticus 21:9 and Genesis 49:4. And again, in these cases, when you see defiled and when you see pollute or profane, it's this same word that's translated began.
Leviticus 21, verse 9. And the daughter of any priest, if she profane herself by playing the whore, she profaneth her father, she shall be burned with fire.
If she profane herself or make herself common. What's the other?
Genesis 49, verse 4. Unstable as water, thou shalt not excel, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, thou then defilest thou it. He went up to my couch.
So, it may, and I think it does, actually have to do with when the Adam, the man, And that's taking us back to consider man, again, in his covenant head, when he begins to let loose of this covenant bond, is what's really going on. It's seen in his daughters first. Or it's seen in his daughters in a peculiar way. Now, who are the sons of God or the children of God? Vinei ha-Elohim, who took these daughters of the Adam in Genesis 6:2. Again, Genesis 6:2.
Genesis 6:2, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose.
Who are they? Well, it's been argued that wherever the term sons of God occurs, that there is this definite reference to the angels. And so, for example, we see this in Psalm 29:1 and Psalm 89:6.
Psalm 29, verse 1. Give unto the Lord, O ye mighty, give unto the Lord glory and strength.
And let me just... O ye mighty, give unto the Lord, O ye mighty. It literally, the Hebrew says, O ye bene Elohim, sons of God. Right? Again, 89:6.
Psalm 89, verse 6. For who in heaven can be compared unto the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened unto the Lord?
And there again, sons of the mighty is sons of B'nai Elohim, sons of God. Or we can see from that God can mean mighty, mighty ones. Now that's important. I'll point that out why in a moment. The idea of the sons of God is talking to the angels. It's asserted this interpretation is the oldest in the history of exegesis. And that assertion is not made just by any old person. There are a lot of popular authors today who've latched on to this. And if it was just, I suppose, any old person, we might be justified in simply dismissing it. But no less than Umberto Casuto, who was a very renowned Hebraist and rabbi who lived to the middle of the 20th century, he surveyed the field on this question, and he says very clearly that this is the oldest, the interpretation is the oldest in the history of exegesis, and I suspect that he's probably right about that. Okay, so, and he himself is going to accept part of the exegesis of the fathers on this passage, but not the whole. And I don't think we need to accept even what he's willing to accept here, but nonetheless, I do accept the fact that this probably is the oldest interpretation of which we have record. Moreover, it is indisputable this term does sometimes reference angels, but it does so as they are an order of intelligent beings of moral, pure moral character. So look at Job 38:7.
Job 38, verse 7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy.
Yeah, that's important because as we think about this, being called the sons of God carries with it the connotation of moral purity. Now, this is important, and I don't want to get too far into this here, but in Genesis, God creates man in his image, in the image of God, in the image of Elohim, he creates man. However, after the fall, when Adam has his first child, Cain, the Bible tells us that in the case of Seth, he says that he was in the image not of God, but in the image of Adam. Right. calling them sons of God here then must be referencing something divine. All right, and it doesn't have to do with their fallen nature, nor does it necessarily reference their spiritual being, like an angel. I mean, what makes an angel a son of God is that he's a holy angel, not that he's a fallen angel. Right, that's what you have to keep in mind here. Because what's about to be described is a fall of some sort. The problem, as I've already pointed out, is this fall, which precipitates the flood, is a long period of time, a millennia plus, after the creation. And yet we know from Genesis 3, the angels that fell had already fallen. Right? Satan had already fallen. There had already been this fall into sin. And so the fall that's happening there cannot be a second fall of angels. Because there isn't, unless this is it, there is no other account of a second fall of angels. Only a reference to a single fall, Satan and his angels falling. Now, these beings mentioned here are not that. They're not angels. Why? Nor do the angels have the capacity for procreation. Matthew 22:30.
For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven.
So, angels can't procreate, all right? It can't be fallen angels that are in view, if it was angels that were in view, because they're already fallen. They wouldn't be sons of God in that respect. Now, I'm going to answer, there's an argument that they'll bring to this, but trying to say, and Casuto himself uses this, but I'll get to that in a moment. Let me just assert, the sons of God is figurative for those who are arrayed on the Lord's side. Now look at Exodus 32:26, Deuteronomy 32:5, Isaiah 1:2, and Hosea 1:10.
Exodus 32:26, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him.
Deuteronomy 32:5. They have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are perverse and crooked generation.
Isaiah 1:2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me.
Isaiah 1:10. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, "Ye are not my people," there it shall be said unto them, "Ye are the sons of the living God."
So when the Hebrew says children in Deuteronomy and Isaiah, the word is sons. Okay, and in Hosea, sons of the living God. These are the ones who are on the side of God. They're believers. They're true believers. The word is being used figuratively, just as Noah's called the son of 500 years. If you look at Genesis 5:32,
and Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
Yeah, we just translated 500 years old, but the Hebrew literally says he was the son of 500 years. And likewise, Abraham calls Eliezer son of my house in Genesis 15:3.
Genesis 15:3, and Abram said, "Behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir."
Yeah, the son of my house. Right, that's what he's calling it. These are figurative usages. But it's a figurative usage for true believers. However, the term sons of God does, in fact, I think, seem to connote a council of holy ones, or gathering of holy ones, those who are gathered for the true worship of God. And we see that particularly in Job 1, 6, and 2, 1.
Job 1, verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came among them, came also among them.
Job 2, verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord.
So it was a day. What was the day when they came to present themselves? It was a Sabbath day. And where is this transpiring? Well, clearly it can't be in heaven. Why? Because Satan has already been cast out of heaven. Look at Revelation 12, 9.
Revelation 12, verse 9. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him.
So what's happening? We have a meeting of the church, a gathering of the church. Sons of God is referring to the gathering of the church. It's referring to the true church, true believers. Now, the Targum, Angelos, has for sons of God, it's either Angelos or Genesia, one of the Targums on this, lists them as the sons of rulers, because Elohim can mean rulers or mighty one, right? Mighty ones, the mighty. But here, I think it clearly is talking about the church, the true church. It's not talking about rulers. That would make them tyrants, what they're doing. But calling them sons of God wouldn't fit with what we would expect the attribution of Elohim being tied to wicked men at this point. Okay? That's not how they start out. In this passage, they don't start out as unbelievers. These are believers. It's the assembly of believers. So we know that these assemblies are under the scrutiny of angels, elect and evil, whereby the ministers are also called by that name angel. Look at Ecclesiastes 5:6.
Ecclesiastes 5, verse 6. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands?
Yeah, so what is the angel? Well, you know, again, in Revelation 1, we know that the angels, the seven angels, are the ministers of the seven churches. And there are seven spirits, or seven angels, spirit beings, who are over them as well. Right here we see a passage that is thought to reference the rabbi of the synagogue. He's the angel. Don't fumble your oath before the rabbi. Why is he called the angel? Because he's the minister of the assembly. All right, and he stands in the place of that unseen angel. And so those assembled are reminded of this supernatural dimension being present in their worship. If you look at 1 Corinthians 11:10.
1 Corinthians 11, verse 10. For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels.
Yeah, one of Paul's arguments for women covering their heads is the angels are watching, right? And I've talked about this in a different context, but the fact is that these angelic forces, elect and evil, they're peering in. And in Job's case, Satan is there. Why? Because he wants to sift Job. So he's asking permission. But he's not in heaven. Right? Although there is a sense in which the church, when it gets together to worship, the church is carried up into the heavenlies, if you will. So the closest Satan can ever get to heaven again is to invade the worship of the church. And it's there that he's making trouble. So we shouldn't be surprised if there is demonic activity going on with respect to the sons of God, should we? We already know Satan could be present there. And he is. But the sons of God are not fallen angels. They're true believers. Or the true church, consisting of true believers and, you know, the wheat and tares. But they're professing the true religion. Now, the daughters of men has often been understood to refer only to the daughters of the Cainites, which mingle with the sons of Seth, the Sethites. Again, Genesis 6:2.
Genesis 6, verse 2. That the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose.
But I think this is a both unnecessary and unwarranted interpretation, because the daughters of men has already been defined in the previous verse as those females descended by a natural generation from both the lines of Seth and Cain. Again, Genesis 6:1.
Genesis 6, verse 1, and it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them.
Yeah, it doesn't... The distinction there is not between the line of Cain and the line of Seth. They should keep them separate. Why? Because they know from that proto-evangelium, that verse, that the seed of the serpent will be crushed, the head of the seed of the serpent will be crushed by the seed of the woman. Right? They know that there's a distinction then, that there are two sorts of people in the world. And the line of Seth, which is the line of the true believer, should keep himself from the unbeliever. Does that guarantee that everyone from the line of Seth is going to be a believer? No. And so, daughters of men is simply a general phrase used here to remind us that there should have been reference to the promise of God. They should, in fact, have married with an eye to the promise of God, the covenant of God, the covenant of grace. But the problem is here outlined as twofold. Right, the first thing is this. The sons of God, those who profess to be true believers, the ones who are members of the true church and assembly of God, we're told they beheld these daughters, that they were fair, or as the Hebrew, good. Tovot. That's the feminine for good. And in doing so, when they look upon them and make that determination, they're replicating the sin of Eve. Look at Genesis 3:6.
Genesis 3:6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat.
All right. And second, again, like Eve with the fruit, they took those women, which they determined to be good for themselves, for wives. Again, Genesis 3:6.
Genesis 3, verse 6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat.
And by doing that, they're substituting their own choosing, their own choice, for that of God. Again, Genesis 6:2.
Genesis 6, verse 2. That the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose.
So what is it that the sons of God, the members of the true church, what are they doing that's so bad in this case? They're succumbing to the temptation of Satan. Remember, Satan said to Eve, God knows that the day you eat of that fruit, you will be like gods, knowing good and evil, or determining what's good and evil. What are they doing? They determine what's good and what's evil here. If they're not doing it with reference to what God says, his promise, they're doing it because they find them attractive. They're doing it because they find something they like in them, and having found what they like, that becomes sufficient rationale for them taking these women to be their wives. Now, I want to be clear. There are a lot of things that are not happening here, right? Unlike the assertions of some, there's no indication that there's any kind of incest or sodomy or any kind of unnatural something else going on here. They're simply marrying the women that they find attractive without regard. And let me be clear as well. It doesn't mean that sometimes they aren't marrying godly women. Sometimes they probably are, and sometimes they're not. But their rule for determining who they will or will not marry is not the promise of God. It's their own determination of what's good. They've made that determination. So in this, they not only replicate the fall of man, but also the fall of the angels. That's why it's actually compared to that in Jude 6.
Jude 6. And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of that great day.
And it's for this very reason, this choosing of the sons of God here is joined to the sin of the angels, because it's so like it. The angels that fell, and it's given as a reason for the flood. It's not saying that the angels fell by having carnal intercourse with human women. It's not what's in view. The angels fell because they wanted to determine what was good on their own, apart from God. They wanted the right to decide for themselves what would be best for themselves, to determine their own end. Look at 2 Peter 2, 4 and 5.
2 Peter 2, 4 and 5. For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, and delivered them into chains of darkness, to be reserved unto judgment, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly.
So theirs is not like the sin of Sodom, choosing strange flesh, as in Jude 7.
Jude, verse 7, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire.
Right, but the evil here consisted in promiscuous intermarriage without regard to the spiritual character of their wives, so that the godly took wives from amongst the godly and the ungodly without discrimination. It didn't matter to them. The godly didn't care whether their wives were godly or ungodly. It wasn't their first and maybe even their second consideration. And that corrupted the church. I want you to look at Matthew 24:38, what Jesus says about this.
Matthew 24:38, for as in the days that were before, the food they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark.
In the days of the flood, they were doing what? They were eating and drinking, they were marrying and giving in marriage. What's wrong with that, eating and drinking? marrying and giving in marriage. What's wrong with that? I can tell you what's wrong with eating and drinking. Paul says, whatsoever things you do, whether you eat or drink, whatsoever things you do, you're to do it to the glory of God. Right? It doesn't say that they were that you had men marrying men. There's no hint there of sodomy. Right? There's no hint there of anything that most people today would think of as being even morally abhorrent. Right? What are they doing that's so horrible? And then the flood comes. And as someone I was talking to recently pointed out with respect to this verse, you know, think about it. If the answer is these were fallen angels copulating with human women, that would be so bizarrely weird and destructive and horrible that everybody would probably recognize that as being perverse. Jesus doesn't say that's why and then the flood came. He says they were simply eating and drinking, marrying and being given in marriage. In other words, they just simply didn't care. God was not in all of their thoughts. It didn't matter to them. They didn't care. The laxity of their of choice proves a laxity of principle, which opens the floodgates of wickedness. Look at Genesis 6:5.
Genesis 6:5, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was openly evil continually.
Why is it such a bad thing to be not to be careful about the woman you marry? Why is it so horrible? How could it lead to the flood? Because ungodly mothers will not train up children in the way that they should go. They're going to coddle the evil. They're going to encourage the rebellion against God. Look at Proverbs 29:15.
Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame.
Likewise, husbands who've taken the wrong step in marrying ungodly wives cannot prove to be exemplary or authoritative fathers. Deuteronomy 7:3-4.
Deuteronomy 7:3-4. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and destroy thee suddenly.
And weren't they destroyed suddenly when the flood came? What was it that they were doing which was so horrible? You know, the fact remains, people want to find something extraordinary to say it must have happened for there to be this terrible calamity as a flood. It must have been really depraved. In fact, it was. But not in the way that people today think of it. You see, the greatest evil that has ever been perpetrated in the world since the fall is the intermingling of the godly and the ungodly. And the intermingling of their seed. It's in this way the seed of the woman became mixed with the seed of the serpent, contrary to the promise of God in Genesis 3:15.
Genesis 3:15, and I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel.
You know, a lot of people think that it's extreme to separate yourself from all of these worldly practices and all of these ungodly things that, you know, most people say, well, it's not that bad. Or they say it's not even bad. Right? It's not, how bad is it to find a wife that you like? It could be the worst thing in the world to find a wife that you like, if that wife that you like is going to lead you or your children to hell. The determinative factor ought not be what you like or what you want. It ought to be the glory of God. And they didn't have that in view. So why Proverbs says, even the plowing of the wicked is sin. What's wrong with plowing? You know, the modern translations say they try to avoid the force of the verse. None of them translate it the way the King James. Why? They can't stand that idea. What could possibly be wrong with plowing? There's nothing wrong with plowing. It's the plowing of the wicked. They don't plow to the glory of God. So when the church allows itself the luxury of choosing whoever, whenever they're going to marry, it doesn't really matter. They're not concerned about this principle of whether or not I'm getting myself involved with the seed of the woman or the seed of the serpent. That has the deleterious effect that ends in the flood in the ancient world. It corrupted the whole of the ancient world. In fact, Luther on this passage, because you have to remember this occurs right in the middle of the passage about Noah, Luther in this passage actually says he believed that Noah doesn't even get married until he's like almost ready to go into the ark. And if you look at the timing, when he has his kids, it could well be that the timing is all just for them to escape so they don't get caught up in the old world that's about to be destroyed. In other words, by the time his children are being married, Noah himself has waited to have children, which means he waited to marry, and he has children, and he's going into the ark concerned about this very issue, that there has not been care among the church with regard to this issue of marriage. And it's now corrupted the church. And once the church has been corrupted, there's nothing left. Where is the redemption? If the church is gone, there's no hope left. Right? When the church disappears, next time, Jesus is coming back. Because there's no way back from that. Right? God destroys it and leaves eight souls, as we're going to see. So finally, the giants may have been men of extraordinary stature. But the fact is this, if their offspring that are talked about here, if they were giants, they all perished in the flood. We know that because Peter says in 1 Peter 3:20, only eight souls survived. Look at 1 Peter 3:20,
which sometime were disobedient when once the long suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was a preparing, wherein few, that is eight souls, were saved by water.
And it seems that they're called Nephilim here because according to the story, they fell. They fell like children untimely born. Right? Children that were ultimately going to be aborted. How? In the flood. They fell before the judgment of God, and they descended in the realm of the Rephaim, the dead. I want you to look at Ezekiel 32, 20 to 27. There's very interesting parallels going on here, I think, when Ezekiel's talking. It sounds like he could be talking, at least in part, with a look back at what happened in the flood.
Ezekiel 32, verses 20 through 27. They shall fall in the midst of them that are slain by the sword. She is delivered to the sword, draw her and all her multitudes. The strong among the mighty shall speak to him out of the midst of hell with them that help him. They are gone down, they lie uncircumcised, slain by the sword. Asher is there and all her company, his graves are about him, all of them slain, fallen by the sword. Whose graves are set in the sides of the pit, and her company is round about her grave, all of them slain, fallen by the sword, which caused terror in the land of the living. There is Elam and all her multitude round about her grave, all of them slain, fallen by the sword, which are gone down uncircumcised into the nether parts of the earth. which caused their terror in the land of the living, yet have they borne their shame with them that go down to the pit. They have set her a bed in the midst of the slain with all her multitude, her graves are round about him, all of them uncircumcised, slain by the sword. Though their terror was caused in the land of the living, yet have they borne their shame with them that go down to the pit. He is put in the midst of them that be slain. There is Mesher, Tubal, and all her multitude, her graves are round about him, all of them uncircumcised, slain by the sword, though they caused their terror in the land of the living. And they shall not lie with the mighty that are fallen of the uncircumcised, which are gone down to hell with their weapons of war. And they have laid their swords under their heads, but their iniquities shall be upon their bones, though they were the terror of the mighty in the land of the living.
So there are two things notable in that passage. Again and again, the use of the word, they fell by the sword. They fell, nephal. It's a form of nephal. They've fallen ones. They're fallen ones, right? And who are they that have fallen? They're the mighty. They're called the mighty, just as they're called, it's Giborim, just as they're called in Genesis 6:4.
Genesis 6, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown.
Yeah, so it's, I think, important to see that Ezekiel appears to be looking back at that and pointing out these were mighty men, right? And they fell, Nephilim, they're fallen ones. Whereas these judgments are replicated down through history. Right? The fact is that the flood, as Jesus shows in the Olivet Discourse, that is a picture of the coming again of Christ, that final judgment when everyone gets caught in it. And the only one who escapes, the only ones who escape, are those who are in the ark. Now, I think, moreover, we need to note, Scripture doesn't say here, and this is important, it doesn't say that these giants, these Nephilim, that they were wicked and unjust among themselves, as the monsters of the fables, the ancient Greek and Latin mythos, right? They're not described like the Titans who are wicked and unjust among themselves. Rather, their offense is toward God. He saw, says Moses, that they were evil. Not that they saw among themselves, that they perceived it. Look at, again at Genesis 6:5.
Genesis 6, verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
Right, so what we know then from this is what Isaiah teaches, that the eyes of God perceive and judge quite differently from the eyes of men. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9.
Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts.
So God judges not because they were wicked to one another necessarily, or mistreating one another. Again, go back to the image that Jesus gives. They were eating and drinking, they were marrying and giving in marriage. It doesn't say they were robbing one another, they were murdering one another, they were sodomizing one another, or anything else like that. It's the kind of thing that people today would confess, there's nothing there. There's no there there. They've done nothing wrong. What have they done that's so wrong? And yet Genesis tells us what they did in the eyes of God was not only wrong, it was so wicked that he had to destroy the entire ancient world. And the only thing we can conclude is that they determined among themselves what was good and bad when it came to marriage. And they took to themselves wives based on their own standards rather than the standards which God had set in his word by his promise. And that was the end of it all. This is not a story about fallen angels procreating with men. This is not a story that has to do with demonization per se, although I think we can probably argue that the sons of God in the end here were demonized, that the demons were at work in their assemblies because they were corrupted and not kept. And that demonstrates a lack of faith on their part. Right? There was some reason why. So there were disobedience, acts of disobedience leading up to this that opened them up for this full-fledged spiritual assault. So the things that we see going on around us that are more severe than this are evidences, I would argue, of a much greater spiritual assault than was coming upon the church prior to the flood, the antediluvian church. And if we're going to turn it back, we need to understand what we talked about with exorcism. You know, we have to understand the power is in the gospel and in faith in Christ, and we have to have all of that front and center. Because if we don't have the glory of God as our chief end, we're going to fall into the same kinds of errors again and again that brought a flood on the ancient world. I know that didn't have a lot to do with our topic of angels and demons, but because it's something you're probably going to run into if you ever bring this topic up, or if you talk to someone about it, you at least need to be clear in your mind that Genesis 6 is not talking about that. And frankly, the book of Enoch, which takes that whole line and develops that, the book of Enoch is pseudepigraphal. And it's not just apocryphal, it's pseudepigraphal. You know, Enoch did not write it. There's no evidence that he wrote it. All right, it's an exposition of intertestamental Jewish demonology based upon a faulty interpretation of Genesis 6. And the fact that people are falling into believing this is an evidence that they're susceptible to demonic inspirations, on the one hand, but it's also an evidence that they haven't learned the lesson regarding the need to maintain a distinction between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And as far as that doctrine goes, everything that we've taught with respect to voluntary associations, you know, why we don't do all kinds of things or participate in a lot of things, goes back to this doctrine of the danger of intermingling and what's really going on behind the scenes in that, and the danger that waits ahead. That's really what Genesis 6 is about. So with that, we're at the end of Angels and Demons, and next time we'll be talking about a different topic.